Well, consider a fairly common scene. I think it is a common conversation, or maybe a quick break at work. You have a conversation with someone. Maybe it's even this morning, a friendly passing that you had with someone. Conversations go a little bit something like this many times. Person one, hey, how are you doing? Realizing that can be a pretty loaded question when you ask someone how they're doing. But hey, how are you doing? And then person two's response, I'm just so stressed. I feel like, or it feels like there's never a moment to breathe with everything going on at work, at home, at church. Essentially, the almighty response of, I'm so busy. You've been on one end of that conversation many times. Maybe it was this morning. I'm so busy. Or how about this? How have you been? Again, loaded question. How have you been? And the response is many times, I'm just so tired, right? That's a very normal, typical question. That's a very typical response. I can barely keep up with all the demands from my job. My family life is crazy, and I'm trying to fit in, you know, some me time also. I'm just so tired. I wish there was like 30 hours in a day, because then I wouldn't be tired. But in many of these interactions, even among friends, even in the church, conversations quickly turn or begin to by sharing of the same, I'm overwhelmed and I'm overworked, or at least I feel overwhelmed and I feel overworked. Mankind, I think we would all agree with this, loves to tell others how busy we are. And at times, we like to unleash our one-of-a-kind, never-seen-before-in-the-history-of-mankind schedules that we actually believe should be in, like, the certain area of the Guinness Book of World Records. Like, our schedule is the schedule. Along with this, at times, we like to share with others how drained or exhausted we feel. Then we go on to highlight how indispensable we're drained and exhausted, and yet we like to then share how indispensable we are at the various places such as work and home, and maybe even in the church. Well, I actually think there's a theological response for why we respond in such ways. That these aren't actually surprising responses, for they're actually tied to the sin-tainted world in which we live in. Since the fall, toil and work, although good in and of itself, right? Good in and of itself is both frustrating and exhausting. We will see, though, the problem is not the toil nor the work, for those things are good. But the problem in which we actually should be talking about is not our toil and our work and how exhausting we are. The problem is actually the perspective of the image bearers partaking in the toil and the work. We like to be recognized and noticed for the work in which we have done instead of recognizing the one who gave us the work to do. And so after verse 23 in chapter 2 of this pursuit and the vanity of self-indulgence that Solomon has been going after and this seeking of the pleasures of life, we come to a place in the book, and I, yes, really slowed down. We're going to skip over some verses, but stopping at verse 24 because Martin Luther says this is right here today the point of the book. Verses 24 to 26 is the point of Ecclesiastes. At the end of chapter 1, if you recall, King Solomon laid out this under-the-sun pursuit of worldly intelligence, if you want to say, or wisdom, and he turned every stone and chased after every endeavor to seek after from an under-the-sun perspective. And what did he end with? He said, it's but exhausting and sad. It just leaves you exhausted and sad. And then he got into the pleasures of life, and we're well aware of Solomon had the wealth and the money to pursue every pleasure possible. I mean, if anyone should have written this book, he did write this book because he had it all in the sense of finances to then chase after the things that humans think will satisfy themselves, right? He hired the best comedians, if you want to say, and the best of the best entertainment. He didn't just watch on a TV. He had them right in front of him. The most expensive and pure wine of the time, he drank it. He cheered his body with it, it says. Homes upon homes and gardens and all the things that just the beautiful place to live and to have others live, obviously, as we know, with him. The vast amount of slaves then, so to not only build those things, then he gets to hire people to take care of all that stuff for him. He had money on top of money on top of money, and we can read those things in 1 Kings of just how much this guy had. No one's ever compared to the mass amount of wealth King Solomon had. And last, none of those things seemed to satisfy, so then he went after, in the midst of all this, this relentless pursuit and the pleasure of women. Not just one woman, 1,000 women. So if one wasn't enough, let's just keep pursuing woman upon woman. And then he steps back in verse 11, I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, it was all vanity and striving after the wind. There was nothing gained under the sun. All was built by, made by, for Solomon himself. Remember, we walked through that, for myself. I did this for myself. Silver, gold, entertainment, women, all for Solomon. And we won't cover, as I said, 12 to 23, but he comes back to work here again. It's the number one complaint in the world, I would argue. I realize in America, politics might be a close second. We like to argue about maybe the weather at times, depending on what the weather's like. But still, when I worked in the barbershop years ago, and I bet I could talk to many who still do, the number one complaint when you sit down is, I'm so busy and I'm so tired. But let me tell you about all my tired and my busy so I can also be recognized at the same time. Well, if anyone, Solomon hated toil more than anything else, actually. He says this in Ecclesiastes 2. I hated all my toil in which I toiled, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows the guy who comes after me, whether he will be wise or a fool with all that I worked for. Yet he will be master of all for which I was the one who toiled and used my wisdom. And this also is vanity. And if you walk through these first two chapters, you see terms like he's frustrated, he's restless, he's vexed, if you want to say. He's troubled as he thinks through these things and considers the uselessness of them as you run it out as far as possible. He's completely hopeless, having it all and yet having nothing. He's in a pit, if you want to say, of despair, realizing now where he worked so hard for these things. He built it all. And then, by the way, he's going to leave it to his son, Rehoboam. The kingdom's going to split, and 80 to 90% of it's going to be gone again. And as he thought about that, Solomon abhorred this. He hated the labor and the work in which he partook in. He realizes that the ultimate profit would be for that who comes after him. And who knows if the guy's going to take care of it, as he says. In verse 20, it says, I turned about and gave my heart up to despair. Again, those words that are just this hopelessness. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who didn't do any of it. Man, this is vanity too. What has a man from all the toil and striving, which he toils beneath the sun, for all his days are full of sadness and sorrow. And work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. The days of one's entire life, work are full of sadness and burdensome, and it's just tiring. We all know work's called work for a reason, right? It's hard. Not just physically, mentally, work is hard. It can keep us up. God keeps actually mankind occupied with work. You see this in chapter 3. God keeps us occupied. What gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Mornings where the first thing comes to mind, has that ever happened to you? Maybe it happened this morning, is work. There are nights we cannot sleep because of work. Now, I'm not just talking about work like the 9-to-5 job. I'm work, tending to kids, taking care of work in the family, working around the house, schoolwork. Oh, it's coming quickly, guys. Anyways, right? It's not just the 9-to-5. relational work. It's hard. Solomon, then looking at all of these things, again, imagine the trials and the struggles of not just literally building buildings and pursuing this, but just the mental exhaustion of taking care of all this and all the trials and struggles that would go along with it. Solomon at this point has left all of us looking at life as if really it's just one big waste of time. Discouraged, exhausted, hating the very life one lives, for it appears that we're chasing after something that's unchaseable, that it's uncatchable, satisfaction. Why laugh, drink, build, attain, acquire, gather, have a bunch of women in my life, have relationships, if in the end we die anyways? Right? Verse 17, I hated life that's done under the sun. It's grievous to me as I look at this continual repetition, and then we just die? And so in this kind of seed despondency, if you want to say, or despair and sadness, Solomon gets to this very point. And he kind of, in a sea of pessimism, gives us this glimmer of hopeful optimism. We're about to see, as I stated, that the problem with all the pleasures of life that he's already covered are not the pleasures of life. It's how we look at those things in which come our way, including work. It's not work, nor the type of work, nor the profit of the work. The problem with work is the one working. The problem with toil is not toil. It's the lenses in which one views the toil, in which God has given us to toil. And so with that said, let's jump into our first point in verse 24, joy in the toil. There's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. And so in spite of all those items we've covered, all of a sudden Solomon says, there is nothing better. A person can do nothing better. If you're holding an NIV, the phrase, there's nothing better. In Ecclesiastes 3:12, he says, I perceive that there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. One more time in chapter 8, he says, for man has nothing better under the sun. This is the best of the best, if you want to say. And so we go from this sea of vanity to Solomon saying, this is the best life has to offer. If you want to live your best life now, if you want to say, under the sun, here's how you do it. So we should all kind of perk up. Oh, I want to live my best life now. If you want, while on earth, ultimate satisfaction, here it is. There's nothing better for who? You've just been traveling over the wisdom and the pleasures of life and saying it's all... So who are you talking about here, Solomon? Well, it says there's nothing better for a person. Mankind, you and I, human people, any and all persons of any generation this is written to, any culture, nationality, group of people, man or woman, any rich or poor, whoever that may be. For all persons, in spite of your whatever job you have, whatever profession you have, whatever home setup you have, whatever school you go to, this is for us. The guy who spent almost two full chapters discussing vanity of chasing after being satisfied in such thing is now saying there is a way to have satisfaction with such things. Let me say that again. Two chapters saying there's vanity of chasing being satisfied in such things is now saying there is a way to have satisfaction with such things. And so here for the first time, he brings up a way. There is actually a way on this earth to have joy. There's a way to have satisfaction. Because in this context, he adds a phrase. He says, from the hand of God. The lenses in which all things, if you want satisfaction, you have to view such things from the hand of God. He goes on in chapter 3, you see at the end there, this is God's gift to man. In chapter 8, he says that God has given mankind or him under the sun. And so all things, all such things, including the most basic, simple, mundane, day in and day out necessities of life, like eating, that's what he brings up here, eating and drinking, and yes, working, can be joy-filled. And we can have joy in the midst of them. And so when you consider it, the very things that have been done really since the garden itself still today can satisfy. And that word here in the phrase find enjoyment is the command actually. In the sentence, which it actually you can say see, if you want to say see enjoyment or see joy in the midst of it or see satisfaction. In other words, there's nothing better for any and all persons that they should see joy in such things, even as basic as eating, drinking, and working, because they're from the very hand of God. Think through with me pre-fall. Before the fall, there was joy and enjoyment in the basics of eating, drinking, and working. There was a time, there was this recognition, perfect recognition, just not the gifts that they were partaking in that the earth was filled with. There was this recognition and satisfaction and enjoying that which was from the hand of God perfectly. And so his creation and mankind's ability to create, so we weren't just created, we live, God is a creator, we're made in his image, and so we don't just enjoy his creation, they were called to create and procreate. And so sinless, without shame, were created and put in a place where, yes, they communed with God, but they interacted with those things that are on the earth that he put there. In the middle of what? A beautiful garden, fruit trees, rivers, land and sea animals. And what did God say? And have joy, enjoy such things. I made it. You're the apex of it. You are to enjoy those things, but you're also to subdue the earth, right? You are to have dominion over. They were to create as God's creation. And yes, be fruitful and multiply. And so find or see the satisfaction in his creation in the daily task God has given and mankind to do. We know Adam and Eve were called to work before the fall. And yet they obviously made a deadly, not just for themselves, but for all creation, the image bearers, a deadly decision that, yes, changed and tainted the world for now. But it was still good. And so whatever work that we may be doing, and we can think of some of these things, and trying to make us think of mopping floors, doing laundry, building homes, digging holes, tending to children, organizing events, including helping those in sin takes work. Dealing with the messes of life. And as Martin Luther said, all work is kingdom work. Yes, in the church. Yes, in the home. Yes, in the 9-to-5, in the classroom, in the studio, in the doctor's office, and the list goes on, and I know you guys can think of many, many more. And sad to say, the amount of time, energy, and lung capacity mankind, including, sad to say, even those in the church, view such things and have the ability to view such things as from the hand of God, the amount of time, energy, and lung capacity we use to complain about work, all types of work, is really sad. The problem, again, with work is the one who goes on day after day not remembering or recognizing that it's from the hand of God. Solomon says, find joy or see satisfaction. Look at the one word there that he inserts, in. He doesn't say after. He doesn't say analyze what benefit it is. He says, you find satisfaction. This is the best we got here on earth. You find joy in the midst of while you're doing the very task that you're doing. And again, the world, and sad to say, many of us, and myself included, fall into the trap at times of tweaking this a little bit. We say things, there's nothing better, by having the mindset that there's nothing better to enjoy it once I'm done. Like, well, once the work's done, once the mess is cleaned up, once the difficulty of a relationship or the family matter's done, then I enjoy it. We've changed it to say there's nothing better than to find joy once I understand what the profit of my labor is going to be. Am I going to be recognized for this? Am I going to make more money than I maybe, what am I going to get out of this? We've changed to say there's nothing better than to find it once everyone knows how awesome my work is. There's a great meme going around. I love it. It's probably been around for years. Of this, a wife comes home and her husband has simply vacuumed the floor. And he wants like a full blown out cheerleading section to come in recognizing what he just did. Do you not see that I just vacuumed the floor? Guys, have you ever done that? I have. We've changed to say there's nothing better than when this hard, difficult, messy, consuming, inconvenient situation or circumstance in my life is done. Then I'll have joy. Then I'll see satisfaction in it and from it. When it gets better, then I'll step back and say, now I'm going to eat and drink and be satisfied. And Solomon says, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's in the midst of the labor. It's in the circumstance. It's in the situation. It's in that which you are partaking at the very time you are partaking in it. And so joy comes as you look through the lens that God himself, whose hand gave you the very toil or work or situation many times we complain about. In light of seeing the hand in which gave the toil, we are to see satisfaction and enjoy the process, which is the title of the message. Have joy in the process of every mundane, every tedious, continuous, hard, laborious, time-consuming, calendar-changing inconvenience to our oh-so-important priorities of our life. Why? Because God has given it to you. I mean, think about how difficult labor was then. We think work's hard now. I mean, daily shepherding. No one's raising their hand to do that, I can promise you that. Maybe a couple of you. Daily shepherding. Building homes, which, by the way, from my understanding in 1 Kings 7, Solomon's home took 13 years to build. Here we go again. Some of the people building it probably never even saw the end product. At that time, my understanding is that 40 or so was the average life expectancy. So almost half your life, you're building one guy's home. Oh, that's fun. What about daily trying to go out and find dinner, kill your dinner, cook the dinner? By the way, we couldn't instantaneously turn on stoves, or maybe even from our phone nowadays. A kitchen with no running water, no instant on type things, no microwaves, no double ovens, no beautiful countertops to put everything on. No, they probably sat it on the ground. And so Solomon's saying there's nothing better than seeing the hand which gave and gives each and every drink, food, and it enables mankind to find satisfaction and to enjoy as they are content in every situation and circumstance. And really, Solomon is looking back saying, I missed the boat forever. Satisfaction cannot, for it must not come in getting out of the toil, because I'm wealthy, I have as many women as I want, I can hire comedians and I can laugh all day, I can drink the best wine, and I still don't have satisfaction. What's missing? We all know when one task ends, what's standing at the door ready to walk through? The next task, the next hardship. The next difficulty. It doesn't end when you're like 60 or 70 or 80. Joy comes in the midst, he says, of the toil. It only comes once you, it doesn't come once you get out of it. We live in a sin-tainted world. The problem is ourselves. The problem is us. It's not that which God actually gave to see, it's from him. I mean, think of Paul while writing from prison itself. Paul says, he's singing hymns in prison, first of all. And he says, as he goes on in verse 11, not that I am speaking of being in need, for I've learned in whatever situation I'm to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound in any and every circumstance. And if it's okay, I'll add in any and every inconvenience, in any and every hard situation, and in every struggle of life, toils hard. I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger and abundance and need and struggles. Why? Because I know who it came from. He's the one who strengthens me. Remember 24 to 26 here, it's a summary statement, if you want to say, of everything that we've covered so far. If you do not see all of it as from the hand of God, you're but chasing after things that you're going to keep chasing. Because it's in and of themselves, those things do not satisfy. You have to recognize who those things come from. And so as we all see and know, eating, drinking, all of those things that we said are vanity, they're vanity because they're vanity in and of themselves. But as we recognize those things and who they come for, they're not vanity anymore. Including wealth. Ecclesiastes 5 says, everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them. Wealth and possessions and power to, those things in and of themselves are not wrong. It's how we view those things. I love the statement. I brought it up many times. Shannon Hurley says it's not what we have, it's what we do with what we have and for who. There's nothing better for a person as they find enjoyment or joy, whether we eat, whether we drink, whatever we do. Do all for the glory of God. Well, how? Recognizing that it's from God himself. So sometimes we have this idea that God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, and we know that everything was there, but it's like the joy only was when they were face-to-face, like walking perfectly with God in perfect, like, face-to-faceness. But they were enjoying and had joy in the midst of those things which God gave them to enjoy. And so that's our second point. Joy is a gift from God. Verse 25, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Again, all that Solomon said so far is vanity until now, when we realize that God gives us eyes to see that it's all from him. Then all those things are joy-filled. And what it does actually is it drives us back to God. And so when a person, you and I, mankind, us, realize that the things of the earth are from the hand of God, consider this with me, it actually drives us back to the creator of such things. And when we realize that God is the giver of such things, it actually enables us to enjoy them that much more when viewed in their proper place. I love what Joe Rigney said in his book, which is titled literally The Things of the Earth. He says, in Christ, God is restoring what has been lost and reintegrating our love for him and our enjoyment of his gifts so that they do not compete with one another, but instead mutually serve and enhance each other for his glory and for our joy. Again, consider the garden. It wasn't just God and man. There was the coolness, there was the sights and the sounds and the animals and the taste, and let alone marriage with one another, as they had dominion. And we know 1 Timothy says this, for everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. If we stop there, it's not good. Verse 5, for recognize, it's made holy by the word of God in prayer. It's from the hand of God. Again, sometimes we look at the world, and I think we sometimes run two different ways. You have like prosperity type way, and then you have like monk, if you want to say. So we look at the world as if holiness is sitting in a room, taking what Solomon has said is vanity, but just holiness is like, it's just you and God in your Bible all day long. Or you and God in prayer. We sometimes look at things of the world as if we are called to be this kind of by myself with God alone. Again, but that wasn't even what Adam and Eve were doing. Again, I love how Joe Rigney kind of breaks this out, and I will give total credit to this word, Godwardness, which is the attempt to faithfully live out 1 Corinthians 10:31, which we all know what it says. And so he defines this idea of Godwardness as the movement of all that we are in our thoughts, actions, and affections towards God. So this then begs the question, what do we do with the things that are literally not God? Is our movement towards him going backwards as we interact with the things of the earth? So as we do certain things more, is it actually taking away from God? Is becoming more God and pleasing to God actually cutting away everything that God has given us to enjoy? And so we must be clear that enjoying pure, undefiled, on-the-earth things is different than what John Owen outlined in his book, The Mortification of Sin, right? We're called to get rid of sin in our life. Romans 8:13, for if you live according to the flesh, you will die, right? Colossians 3:5a says, put to death, get rid of that which is earthly in you. And what he's referring to is what? Sexual immorality, impurity, passions, evil desires, covetousness, which is idolatry. It does not say put to death the things of the earth God has given to enjoy. It says put to death things of the earth that are sin. And so we are commanded to do all things for his glory. And as we are doing all things on this earth for his glory, directly towards God and indirectly towards God as we interact with his created things. And so he brings up these two words, direct Godwardness and indirect Godwardness. I think it's on your screen there. So direct Godwardness would be our conscious, intentional focus on God himself, which are good things, by the way. So things such as reading the word, praying, corporate worship, Bible study, and confession of sin, things such as that. Our thoughts, our emotions, and our affections focus intentionally and directly on God. We all know that most of our life is not reading the word, praying, corporate worship, and Bible study. We all know that. Now, I realize we're supposed to pray without ceasing, and we could develop that more. But then there's this indirect Godwardness, which is defined as our thoughts and actions focus primarily actually on God's world, which then catapults our emotions and affections being reminded that this is from the hand of God. And so eating, drinking, toiling, working, laughing, wine, creating, all those things that we actually spend a lot of our time with, lots of us go to work every week and not just work outside the home, work in the home, including relationships, being a mom, being a dad, friendships that we pursue, marriages that we have, pleasure within the context of such things, all to be enjoyed, have joy, done for the glory of God, as it's seen from the hand of God. And so think through sitting by the ocean, taking a walk, playing with your kids, grabbing a cup of coffee, going out and playing golf with some friends, volleyball, going swimming, playing games, all vanity, if unrecognized as from the hand of God. All giving glory, if recognized from the hand of God, as it catapults your affections and emotions back to God. But let's not forget, toil, hardships, falling short in competition, family struggles, struggles in life, exhausting situations, financial hardships, the loss of a loved one, those too can be vanity, if not seen from the hand of God, or glorifying if it catapults you to remember that it's from the hand of God. For from him and through him and to him, from him they are given. Through him and back to him are all things. It's the way in which we view such things, not the things in and of themselves. And so there is nothing better than where you are at. In the moment of which you are, in the midst of what you are in, from the toes in the sand, to the laughter of playing with your kids, to love of family and friends and the church itself, to the extreme difficulties of sickness and hardships and sadness. And so from one end of what we call the good things in life to the other end of what we call the bad things in life, and everything in between, to then fully depend on and submit to God, for apart from him, it is an impossibility to have joy in the process, seeing it from where it came from. Let's look at our last point, that God is this ultimate giver of the joy itself. All things are to be seen from the hand of God. He's also the one who gives us the ability to see things from the hand of God. Verse 26, for to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. And so essentially what Solomon does is he splits the world really into two types of people. You have God-pleasers and self-pleasers. By the way, he lived on both sides, if you want to say, at one time or another. And by the way, we did too, and we do also at times. And so this verse really reminded me of that parable of the final judgment in Matthew 25. It says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. And before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. And so God pleasers here are those who live not for the stuff, but the giver of the stuff. God pleasers are completely dependent on the one who provides wisdom and knowledge and joy in the midst of the toil. For we've been given eyes to see, and so as the circumstances and situations and life itself comes every single day that we live, he's given us the ability to see those things through the proper lens. And so God pleasers, by God's grace, gratefully and with thankfulness, receive that which God himself lays before them, and what we call the good and the bad. We, with joy and as we work, are reminded of the work he did for us. Right? As we work and toil, what the things that we call are hard, and they're really good in and of themselves, for God gave it to us. But hopefully it reminds you, even tomorrow, as we work, as we do such things each and every day, that he did all of our work to be right with his Father. And not only did he work on our behalf at the cross, he's working it all out right now. What? For our ultimate good and for his glory. And so God pleasers, God graciously gives wisdom and clarity to life's happenings of each and every day. Again, of both types of times, if you want to say, recognizing it's God who is sovereign, who it's coming from. God enables those who know him to see the big picture in the small moments of life. Consider that. God enables those of us who know God through, by his grace, through his Son, Jesus Christ, to see the big picture of life in the small moments, day-to-day moments of life. As John Piper says, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. And so seeing and finding satisfaction, we've kind of redefined that. I realize we like to do that, is not a life without difficulties. It's a life in the midst of the difficulties. Godly satisfaction is restful dependence, a supernatural, clear-headed comfort that comes from the great comforter. The ones who please God are those who trust not in any of what they have done, but in what he did. And then out of that, they then can recognize all such things that they've already been doing in many ways, but they now see it from the hand of God. For we know apart from him, we can do nothing. We can run to Romans chapter 3, and on one's own, there's none right, no, not one. There's this enmity right between man and God. We cannot do good. We cannot be God pleasers by pulling up our bootstraps and being God pleasers. That's not possible. But we can trust and depend on the one who made it possible, and not just a possible, but completely sure, that which was Christ at the cross. As he lived and he died and he was buried and he was raised on the third day. And we trust in him that he did the work, all of the work, to make us right with God himself. And so we, with joy and at the mercy of he who gives us the toil and the work, we have joy in the process every single day by God's grace. You wake up and you live hour by hour, minute by minute, not knowing always what's going to come at you the next day. And then you wake up and you do it all over again. And you wake up and you do it all over again, and you, as you're doing it and as you're responding, you're remembering that it's from the hand of God. And then we die. As God pleasers, that's what we're called to do, actually. We're called to live in such ways, and then we die. And praise the Lord that God's children, according to Matthew 5:5, says that we will truly inherit the earth. We will reign with him forever. And as we work, we're reminded again of the work that he's done. The sovereign, gracious God saved those who then can be God pleasers. And then he gives us the wisdom and the ability to have joy. Phil Ryken says, if we live for God's pleasure, we will be richly rewarded with all of the spiritual blessings that God loves to give. And we could run through Ephesians 1 and walk through all those things, that all the spiritual blessings that he's given us, adoption, right? And blood-bought new family members. We're a new family in here. He gave us this, right? Excess beyond excess. He's given us wisdom and insight. We can see situations clearly, not by our own doing, but by God's grace. He's given us the ability to do such things. Again, seeing the big picture of life in the small moments that we go through. And then we have a future inheritance waiting for us. Right? For I consider, that's why we can say this. That's why Paul could say this. I mean, we didn't live anything like Paul lived in the sense of difficulties, and yet he could still say, I consider all these sufferings of this present time, not that they weren't hard, but he says it's not even in comparison with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For now, the creation waits with eager longing, because yes, life is hard. We like to complain about it. We like to tell everyone how busy we are and how hard it is, and yet we want to be recognized for it, and that's because we forget who it's from. And so I would encourage you guys, even as Christians, that is a typical response of, I'm so busy and I'm so tired. And it's a response that is separate from that which gave us the busyness and the hardness. And so for God pleasers, we wait. We depend. We rest. We have joy. And we get up and do it all over again. Sad to say, to the sinner, the verse goes on. Who don't know God, you're still digging empty holes. You're actually, Solomon paints an even bleaker picture here. The sinner, those who don't know God, actually continue to dig holes. They gather things and get the picture here. They dig holes that then is the conduit from the things that they gather that they then dump into the hole, and those who are God pleasers acquire them. It says that, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This for them is also vanity. And so for those who don't have a seat at the table, if you want to say, who do not see such things as from the hand of God, judgment And what's the judgment? Gathering, collecting, and giving away. Gathering, collecting, giving away. And then they die. Toil, work, only to end up giving to the God pleasers. And I'll go ahead and end here with a short little analogy that I think was helpful to my own mind. But imagine a farmer who toils, works hard, endlessly in the fields, working day after day after day. He grows this huge harvest. He plants, he waters, he cares for the crops with great effort. However, this farmer has no intention of using the harvest for himself or his family. Instead, his sole purpose is to gather the crops and store them in a large barn. Meanwhile, there's another farmer in the same village who also works hard in the fields. This second farmer is known for his kindness, his generosity, open hand, and dedication to others. He works with a joy-filled heart, knowing that his efforts are blessed and that he's using his resources outwardly. When the harvest season comes, a great storm comes, and the first farmer's barn collapses. All the crops he has painstakingly gathered are scattered. However, the second farmer's barn remains intact, and he finds that his fields have yielded an even greater harvest than expected. And in the end, the first farmer's efforts to gather and collect were in vain, while the second farmer, who worked with his heart pleasing to the one who gave it to him, if you want to come back to the word, received an abundant reward. The crops from the first farmer's ruined barn are now freely available to the second farmer, right? Digging the hole, dumping what you've gathered and collected, only for the God pleaser to then take. And so for those who do not find ultimate satisfaction in the one who gives such things, you're just going to keep digging holes, and life's going to be empty. And sad to say, That's the sad reality maybe of some of us sitting here. Being created, living a life of empty pursuits in and of themselves, only to then leave it to another. Endless toil of digging, emptying, never collecting, and then you go back to dust. We aren't going to read it for the sake of time, but if you go all the way to the end of the book in chapter 12, Solomon walks through, he talks to young people, and I would say he's not just talking to 12-year-olds. He's saying, essentially, don't waste your time. Don't waste your time by forgetting that who all these things that God has given us to enjoy, who it's from. Because you're going to get older, and then you're going to die. And so that's my encouragement to anyone who's digging holes with emptiness at the end. Time's going quickly. We're called to actually enjoy all such things, the pleasures of the world, as we recognize them from the hand of God.